Hello, and welcome back to the Stories from the Ashes podcast, where we pontificate on good books and the stories that define and refine us. I am your host, Amber, and I am here with Inara as a co-host, and we are talking today with author Millie Florence. Welcome, Millie.
Hello, it's wonderful to be here.
Millie, you are a young author for those who are not able to see you right now. You are 16, is that correct?
No, actually. Now I'm 20.
Oh, you're 20. Okay. Even better. But you were young when you...
Yes. I published my first book when I was 13, my second okay. when I was 15, and yeah.
Okay. I think I had seen that age progression written somewhere, but it seemed like that was bringing us up to the present at 16. And I was like, I think she's older than 16, but okay.
No, yeah, it's because I look so young. I have people who come up to me and think that I'm still like 13 or 14.
Yeah.
It's my superpower. I can. Yes.
It'll pay off.
I can just disguise as a middle grader.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, so you published at 13. It wasn't just that you.
I did.
Wrote your first book at 13. So that is fantastic. And your third book is coming out, The Balter of Ashton Harper, which is releasing from Bandersnatch Books on October 17th. And we are very excited for that. I was contacted by the editor asking me if I'd be interested in reading an advanced copy and endorsing it if I liked it. And I did not recognize your name at first blush, but Inara was reading over my shoulder and she was like, yes, we are going to read Millie's book, because I had bought her your book that has Mulberry in the title. What is it, Inara?
Lydia Green of Mulberry Glen.
There we go. Lydia Green of Mulberry Glen. And so Inara had read one of your books already and she was like, we're going to read that one. So we did. And I did really enjoy it.
So much.
So we did endorse it and we're very excited to be able to talk to people about it. So one of the ways that we like to get to know our guests is through their favorite books. So could you share with us three of your favorite books or most influential books in your life?
So for most influential, it would definitely be, and there are exactly three of them, Anne of Green Gables by Ella Montgomery, and then A Little Princess and The Secret Garden by Frances Hodgson Burnett, because those three I had on audiobook, because they were in the public domain, so you can get the audiobook for free, and my parents got those on audiobook for me, and I listened to those three when I was like 5 years old and up, just over and over again on repeat. There was a solid 2 or 3 years where it was just those books all the time, were always on in our house. So just because I listened to those so many times, that had a huge impact on me and how I thought about writing and storytelling. My favorite book, though, that I would say more recently is The Mysterious Benedict Society by Trenton Lee Stewart, just because, in my opinion, it's the perfect middle grade novel. It has everything I love in a story. It has humor and adventure and cool characters, but also really deep messages and a lot of heart in it. And it explores some more like difficult and thought-provoking subjects, and has beautiful language and super clever. It's just like everything I want in a book. It's the sort of book I wish I had written. So yeah. I would say that is my favorite. Yeah. But the first three were definitely the most influential for me.
I love that. Have you had a chance to watch the TV show that they made?
For the Mysterious Benedict Society? Mm-hmm. I will refrain from saying too much because I could go on like an hour-long rant, and I have with my friends, about all the things. Okay, in a nutshell, the first season was okay, but it felt like they were adapting more of the plot than the actual story. Mm-hmm. Like, the heart of the book, the themes that they were trying to talk about in the book felt a little bit watered down. Mm-hmm. And it felt more like they were almost trying to tell the same plot, the same events that happened, but they weren't really talking about the same themes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that really annoyed me.
Yeah. We only watched the first episode and then just kind of moved on to watching something else. So I didn't
The first episode was the best. honestly, okay. of the series. I don't feel like it got better from there.
Good to know. Do you remember the first book that made you cry?
That is a hard one. I think it was either The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins, or it was the last Harry Potter book. Mm-mm. I don't remember like the order in which I read those two books, but those were two earlier books that I remember like actually making me cry.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm allowed to spoil what in those books made me cry.
No spoilers.
Maybe not.
We pretend like even spoiler, if the book is, spoiler, you know, 20 years old that people haven't read it. That's the assumption we go off.
Okay, there we go. Good to know. Every podcast has like different thoughts on that, so I always try to be careful.
Yeah, sometimes we record two episodes with an author, like the first one just to talk about the book, and then the second one if I've already read it, so that we can rant about it. And that one we like.
Oh, I love that.
We clearly mark it as a spoiler episode, and it's generally more like 10 or 20 minutes. But yeah, we try to keep the spoilers out for people that want to have the surprise. So your book, the most recent one that I read, The Belcher of Ashton Harper, it reflects a lot of creativity. So do you have hobbies and interests outside of your writing that you feel inspire your imagination?
Yes. And it's hard for me to, like, when I first, that question is difficult at first, like, glance for me, because I feel like I spend most of my time writing. Like, mm-hmm. It just takes over my life and my days. And I love it. But I was like, at first I was like, well, wait, what else do I do? I don't know. I just write books all day. No, but it's actually interesting because one of those hobbies that I do outside of writing is dancing. Not seriously, but for those of you who don't know about Balter, The Belcher of Ashton Harper is about a couple siblings who live in the Regency era and are trying to get into this academy for artists and specifically dancers, because they are ballroom dancers and they want to turn that into their career. And I also love dancing. That's a huge part of the reason I decided to write about it in Balter. I took classes when I was younger. I don't anymore, but it's the sort of thing, like, I'll dance around my room, you know, to mm-hmm. my own music. And I actually, for Christmas one year, my dad took me to a Regency era ball, like a Regency era themed ball. So everyone mm-hmm. was dressed up in period costumes, and we got to do a lot of the traditional dances, and it was super cool. And I love that. I feel like a lot of the hobbies I have outside of writing are like the opposite of writing, in terms of the fact that, like, they're quite a bit more physical. So obviously dancing is a lot more physical than just mm-hmm. sitting at a desk and typing words. And it's the same with a few of my other hobbies. For example, acting. I do a lot of acting. Most recently, I played Louisa in a college production of The Sound of Music. Wow. I love acting because that is like, it's playing out a story, but it's a lot more of like a physical medium, because I actually get to be a character and mm-hmm. go through all the motions that they go through. I love acting. And I feel like it's adjacent to writing as well, because it's basically just putting myself in the headspace and in the emotional space of that character, which I already do when I'm writing. Just instead of expressing it through words, I'm expressing it through my body language and my tone of voice. Those are the two yeah. big ones. And then I would also say cooking, which can definitely be an art form. I love to cook. So
that's great. Thank you for recapping what the book is about. And I was not familiar with what the word Belcher meant going into it. So I appreciated the definition being on the back cover. The dance. And so Belcher means to dance yes. artlessly without particular grace or skill, but usually with enjoyment. And I really like that, because I actually went before our fire. So like 4 years ago, I got into adult ballet and took ballet for a couple of years. And I was definitely baltering. It was very great. Yeah. I did not have skill, but I very much enjoyed it.
There's something so beautiful, though, about doing something just because you enjoy it, and just yes. purely for the joy of it. And I yes. think that's really special.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed the mindset of, you don't have to be good at any of your hobbies. for them to have benefit.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
exactly.
Serve you. Inara also dances, not professionally, but she is she does tap and ballet and hip hop, and she really blew me away with lyrical her tap this year too. Because it was her lyrical and jazz as well. It was her first year in tap, and that is not easy to pick up, and she just seamlessly jumped into this class with girls who had been taking it for years, and that was amazing. But Inara, do you want to tell Millie about your experience with a Regency ball? Because I saw you smile when she was talking about hers.
Oh, have you been to a Regency themed ball?
Oh, well, when I was 3, I really loved Jane Austen. I don't know if I had read the books or if I just watched like the Pride and Prejudice.
You had watched like all the BBC versions of the movies.
I'm sure. So for my 4th birthday, I asked for a birthday ball, like what they have in Jane Austen, how they're constantly having parties and balls. And so Mom and Dad, we rented a big house that's like out in the middle of nowhere or something. And everyone showed up in fancy ball gowns, and it was a lot of fun. We danced and ate cake. And we had, like, specially made dresses. You could probably, like, show a picture of it in the show notes, Mom. Like, our outfits.
Yeah, I can share a picture. What I didn't realize we were able to do is you can rent costumes from the Jane Austen Society in the United States. And so it was easy to find dresses.
Yes, I've seen that.
But my husband rented like the full getup with the top hat, and all the men came with ascots. And one of our friends stood at the door with a cane that he would bang on the ground and announce every person that came in the door. And the house that we had rented was period appropriate. And it was an absolute blast. And we were really happy.
That sounds so amazing. Oh my goodness. This was for your 4th birthday, Anna?
Yes.
She's the eldest child. After your eldest child turns like 6, all the birthdays for everybody just drop off. So we were really glad that we had gone all in that year. So what role
it's
has...
It's a very sophisticated interest for a 3-year-old. Yes. I'm impressed.
My dad absolutely loved Jane Austen, and he was very sick when Inara was little. And so she would spend a lot of time on the couch with him watching straight through the 8 hours of the BBC Pride and Prejudice because, like she said, almost every scene they're back at a party, and she thought that was great. And so starting at 2, she would just sit through the 8 hours of the movie just to snuggle with her grandpa. So it was kind of a special thing that they both were able to be at this before he passed. So we really liked that.
I love that. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm also a huge fan of Jane Austen, which you could probably assume from the fact that I'm writing a book that takes place in her time period about dancing and balls and things. Yes, I'm also a huge Jane Austen fan, so that's absolutely amazing. I'm a little bit jealous.
Well, if we do it again, we'll invite you. So
yes.
So with... You mentioned the 3 books that you had read and listened to over and over again. But beyond that, currently, what role does reading play in your writing journey? And are there any books that have influenced the way that you have approached your own work?
Yeah, I'm a very big reader. It's interesting. There are some writers who they just write books. They don't read them as much. Mm-hmm. And they can write great books. So I'm not one to say that like, oh, it's essential that you're constantly reading books if you're a writer. I think at the beginning, yeah. But I think that's a bit of a myth that you constantly need to be reading to be a writer. Mm-hmm. But I do read a lot. And I'm not always the fastest reader. Again, writing tends to take precedent over reading, but I do read a lot. One of the things that I've actually found that helps me out a lot as an author is if I'm not feeling inspired to write, I'll go sit down and read instead. And that often helps me get more in the mindset of writing, and it gets me excited about writing again because I get to experience that wonderful magic of a well-told story. And it gets me excited to sort of make my own stories because I want to live up to that now. So I think that can be very, very helpful. And I'm also a big fan of breaking down books that I really like and figuring out how they work, sort of discovering the story structure, the skeleton underneath. Because when you just read as a reader, you're just enjoying the story. But if you go over it again, from more of a craft perspective, you can really dig deep and see what the author is doing and why they're doing it and how it works, or maybe how it doesn't work. And you can ask questions like, well, how could I have done this better? Right. And I think that's a super valuable experience as a writer.
Yeah, definitely. With your journey into being a published author beginning at such a young age, what challenges did you encounter differently then than you encounter now in the publishing experience?
So, challenges that I encountered then that I don't encounter now. It's interesting. It's kind of a difficult question to answer because it's hard to tell what challenges I encountered just because I was new at it rather than because I was young, right?
Yeah.
Because you can be I'm a big believer of, you know, considering a lot more experience than age, right? So I was 13 when I published my first book, but I'd still been writing for like 7 years before that. So even though I was very young, I was a more mature writer than some adults because I'd been writing for so long. But I was very, very new to the publishing process. So there's a huge learning curve there, a ton of experience that you have to learn and gain before you're going to be really a pro at it. And there's definitely things I did publishing my first book that I would do differently now. Mm-hmm. But that's all a part of the learning process. And all in all, I think it turned out very good for my first attempt. And obviously it worked because people are still reading it today, right? And I still get lots of good reviews on it today. So it's hard to tell what challenges are from just learning about that publishing process versus being young.
Right.
I will say I definitely have a lot of funny stories about people realizing how young I am, especially at like book signings and things. Specifically, I remember one time I was doing a book event at Barnes & Noble, and I'm sitting behind a table of like all of my books. It's like 10 or more copies of the same book with my name on it. Mm-hmm. And this one older gentleman comes up to the table and he goes, "Is this your favorite book?" And I went, "Well, I would hope so because I wrote it." And he's like, "You did?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "How old are you?" And I told him. And you could just tell in his eyes that he did not believe me. And I've always thought that story was so funny. I've also had similar, although less extreme, reactions from people. But yeah, when people encounter a young author, I think there is a certain group who are a lot, I don't know, I think people think of what they were writing when they were my age, you know, and then they expect it to be like their middle school creative writing assignments, you know, when in reality, I've been doing this for a long time, even if I am very young. So, but I just find it funny more than anything. And if anything, I feel like it pushes me to try and prove myself even more because I really have to prove myself to some people because of my age. But I choose to see that as an advantage rather than a disadvantage because it means I'm going to put in the work that adult authors will not. I'm going to spend more hours on this, more time, spend more time learning than adult authors will. And the end product will be that my book is better than a lot of those adult authors who aren't doing the same things. So. Mm-hmm. And also, I still look really young, so there are still some people who come up to my booths today and assume that I am 13 or 14. So I think I'm still experiencing some of those things, you know?
Yup. Those baby faces, they'll get you every time.
Yeah.
So can you tell us about the support systems and mentors that you had along the journey? Because, I mean, there's a lot of things you just can't do for yourself between 13 and 16.
Yeah. So, I mean, my parents were instrumental. They've always been so supportive. Like, the biggest thing they have always done for me is just to listen to me when I am ranting about something, whether it is the story that I'm in the middle of writing or if I'm trying to figure out publishing, that sort of thing. So they've always been amazing. If I ask questions, ask them to like help me with research and stuff, they're always there for that. But publishing, like, very much it was my thing. I figured out, you know, how self-publishing worked and what distribution company would work the best. And I had some technical help from my dad, but overall it was very much like my thing. Like I was the one putting it all together, but they were there as a great support system. The biggest things that they have done for me is to be supportive and to mm-hmm. encourage me and tell me to keep going even when I don't feel like it, and tell me that I can do it even when I don't feel like it, because it can be hard to believe in yourself sometimes. But they've always been amazing. And like just the homeschool education they gave me was a huge part of it, because you learn so much about being self-motivated and self-disciplined and figuring stuff out and teaching yourself things when you're homeschooled and you're taking a greater initiative in your education. Also, in terms of quote unquote mentors, I found a lot of information online. Through videos and blogs or books at the library. Something I always recommend is the book Spilling Ink by Anne Mazur and Ellen Potter. That is a great book for young writers. The tagline for that book is a handbook for young writers about writing. And I read that for the first time when I was 11 or 12 years old. And that was my favorite book I think I've ever read about writing. For mm-hmm. younger writers. So if you have a young writer, I highly recommend Spilling Ink. It's a great place to start.
I'll have to grab a copy of that one. Collaborating with publishers and editors can be a very unique experience. I've been talking with lots of publishers and editors lately, and it is fascinating to me everything that they do. And do you have any insights that you can share about that collaboration process over the years for you?
Yeah, I think I kind of expect, because I self-published my first two books, and now I'm working with publishers on mm-hmm. my next couple books. And I expected it to be more difficult than it mm-hmm. actually turned out to be, which mm-hmm. was very interesting. Whenever I self-publish my books, I always put myself through like a rigorous amount of feedback, partially because, you know, I saw myself as so young and I'm like, I really want to put in that extra work to make sure this is really good, because I want to prove myself to other people. And so, I mean, I had multiple rounds of beta readers. I would do huge edits that meant I had to like rewrite half the story. So then I kind of expected something similar from like editorial letters and stuff when I got published. And I expected, like, you know, bigger changes and that they would have, like, lots of opinions and that sort of thing. So then when I actually got published and I started working with editors, what they called developmental edits is what I would consider to be more like smaller edits, because mm-hmm. I've done developmental stuff that is huge, like rewrite mm-hmm. entire chapters huge. And I didn't get any of those edits from my publisher. And now maybe people do. I think some people definitely do. I think it depends on how done your book is once you sign it with the publisher. Yeah. For me, my books were very done. So I got much smaller change requests, which was very nice, but it kind of caught me off guard. And even recently with one of my publishers, we just got, for a different book, not the Walter Bastian Harper, but we got an editorial letter back on that book. And you know, my publisher emailed me like, oh, are you okay? I know getting editorial letters is always the most difficult part of the process for me. And I was like, I mean, yeah, I'm fine. And she was so surprised. And she was like, oh, really? You are handling this so well. And I'm like, it's just practice. Like, I think it's because I'm so used to getting so much feedback that it prepared me very well for the traditional publishing process.
Yeah, I love that. I can see how beta readers could definitely prepare you for that. We did an interview with Rachel Lulich, and she said that with beta readers, she found she often is facing two types of readers, and she can sort them out pretty quickly. One type is people that think you should be writing a book other than the book you're writing. And so their feedback is like, I would do it this way and all of that. And then there's the people that actually have caught the vision and are like, okay, well, with what you're working with, this is what I think I'm noticing. And so I could see how getting a lot of those types of feedbacks could definitely prepare you for editor feedback professionally.
Yes, definitely. The best feedback is always from a reader who understands the type of story you're trying to write. I agree with that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
If you could co-write a book with any author, living or dead, who would it be and what genre would it be in?
Okay. Absolutely J.R.R. Tolkien and fantasy. There's so much there I think I could learn. I definitely don't feel like I'd be worthy of co-authoring a book with him, but hey, I would absolutely love the experience. Mm-hmm. I love Lord of the Rings. I love The Hobbit. And I also love the fact that he was able to write both because they have such different writing voices. Like he can easily write, well, I don't know how easily, but he can write a wonderful, charming, funny, quirky middle grade. And also this much deeper, darker, grittier adult story that are both set in the same world. And I love that so much. And I love his world building and how clever he is and how he can put a story together that is so multifaceted and has so many wonderful themes and that just like all work together really, really well. So maybe a little bit generic, but definitely J.R.R. Tolkien.
My mom asked me that question last night and I had the same answer, but I was...
You had the same answer?
I'm not sure if I would be able to add anything to his books. Like, I don't think co-authoring with him would be an entirely good idea because he would do so much better on his own. So, that was my reasoning.
I mean, hey, if there is any opportunity for me to, like, write with J.R.R. Tolkien, I don't care how big of a fool I make myself. Because I would just learn so much from him, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So balancing school, writing, and the publishing process must be quite the feat. And how do you manage your time effectively and stay focused on your goals?
Well, now I've officially graduated from homeschool high school. So I'm actually doing this full time for the present and hopefully far into the future. And I mean, it depends on how many books I sell, right? So please go buy my book if you want me to write more quickly. but back when I was homeschooled, I always made it my goal to like finish my schoolwork in the morning, for example, and then I would spend the afternoon writing. I think that was my general goal, but obviously it got a lot more complicated than that because it depends on the day. It depends on what we're doing. It depends on if we're going to co-op or not, that sort of thing. Our homeschool was mostly eclectic, which means we used a variety of different approaches and resources depending on what worked best for each individual kid. And it was strongly inspired by like Charlotte Mason and classical education. And it had lots of read alouds and audiobooks and an emphasis on conversation. So a lot of our homeschool experience was just like having big conversations with my parents and my siblings about anything from current events and books and movies and politics and religion. It was very like experience focused, right? Which doesn't mean I didn't have essays. I did. I did write some essays. but mostly it was directed in a lot more of a... My mom likes to say delight directed, right? So it was very flexible. And that definitely informed the way I write as well, right? And I think being homeschooled is a huge reason why I'm able to do what I do now, because I started so early and my parents gave me the time and they counted the time I spent writing in my high school credits, right? Mm-hmm. They saw that as super valuable. Also the time I spent marketing my books, you know, writing business emails and like learning how that whole world of marketing and promotion works is also super valuable. There's so much I learned just from pursuing what I'm passionate about, like mm-hmm. pursuing pursuing a career is the best teacher at the end of the day. So I learned a ton from that. And my parents were always open to working that passion into our schoolwork and our day-to-day homeschool, which was super, super helpful.
Yeah, I love that. So your book covers some highly relatable sibling dynamics. And so I'm very curious where you fall in birth order. And there are important themes of self-forgiveness and belonging. So how did your personal experiences and perspectives shape the story and the way that you wanted to tell it?
So first of all, I find it super interesting that you mentioned belonging and self-forgiveness, because those are not themes I thought of while writing The Balter of Ashton Harbor, which I think is a testament to like how a book can resonate with different people. I think those themes are definitely there, but they weren't the main focus for me when I was writing that book. So I just think that's super cool. Like, you made me super happy just now. It's like, she noticed some very cool things that I didn't even entirely mean to do, which is always a wonderful moment. Gotta have those little happy accidents.
Yes.
But with specifically like sibling dynamics, that is something I definitely purposefully focused heavily on in The Balter of Ashton Harper. And a big reason, so you asked where I am in the birth order. I am the oldest in my family.
That was my guess. So the three of us represent three eldests here.
Nice. Okay. Oldest sibling club. Woo. I've always felt from a very young age, there's a huge like lack of well-represented sibling dynamics in like middle grade fiction. And when I was younger, the books I always read always had like really kind of horrible oldest siblings who were just not nice to their younger siblings. Mm-hmm. And it made me want to not be that person. I wanted to definitely not be that character. And it really forced me to think about that and how I treat my younger siblings. And I decided I'm not going to be like that. And I made the goal to just be like the best big sister I can possibly be. That was a huge part of, especially my early childhood. I was like, I want to be a really good big sister. And even some people have heard the statistic, but siblings often shape and influence each other more than the parents do. So I think that relationship is just, it's very complicated and it's very important because it's so formative for kids and especially for homeschool kids because you spend a lot of time with your siblings. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I really wanted to shine a nuanced light on, because most of the books, middle grade books I've read that focus on siblings is either like, they love each other so much, or there's one sibling who's just horrible and is just brushed aside and you never really get closure for that. They just have a really bad older sibling or younger sibling, but it's usually the older sibling. So I really wanted to show a more nuanced approach to that really explored all the complexities of that relationship. And some of that came from personal experience. Now, the Harper's sibling dynamic is definitely very, very different from me and my siblings, partly just because there are five of us and there's only three of them. But it allowed me to explore, you know, the relationship, like how it feels to be a middle child, the expectations for an oldest child, and just how all of those relationships connect and intertwine. And that's just something I was really passionate about exploring.
Yeah, I really like that. Inara is also the oldest of five. And it really changes things. And I think that's part of why we really enjoy Edith Nesbit, is they have so many sibling clusters that are more like 4 to 6 kids, and they all just look after each other so well and respect each other and love each other and care for each other. And how many sibling groups today would you see the kids just like go off for the day on an adventure with like the 1 to 3 year old in tow? And that was that's what Nesbit's characters did, and it was just part of their life and how they took care of each other and included everyone. And so I really appreciated that example. But you're right.
I have read Five Children and It by Edith Nesbit, and I really enjoyed that one.
You should read The Railway Children and see what you think of that one.
I have read that one. I listened to Railway Children. Oh, okay. That was a long time ago, though. I was like 6 or 7 when I listened to that one, so yeah. It might be time for a reread.
it's so beautiful. How do you hope that your readers will connect or relate to the themes? I think that's a funny question, given how I was picking out themes that weren't even there, but the themes that you put there intentionally for them to connect to, what themes did you see that were intentional that you're really hoping that the readers will connect with?
So the big theme in The Balder of Ashton Harper is the balance of like art and turning it into a career, right? And how do you balance those two when you're trying to find success in the artistic field? So for them, it's dancing. How do you balance that artistic side of it with the expectations that come with having to be professional? That's part of it. A big part is also just like dreaming and having these big dreams that I had when I was younger, and I know a lot of kids have. And are they worth dreaming? Right? Even when stuff gets hard, like how worth it is that dream to you? And at what point is there more important things in life than that dream? And at what point do you choose to not give up on that dream because it is really important to you and you feel like it's your way to make an impact on the world, right? So it's a big exploration of that in Balder. And, you know, you said, how do I hope readers will connect and relate to those themes? Ultimately, I hope it gets them thinking. I never want to just give my readers the full answer. The point of fiction is not to tell a reader four, but to give them 2 + 2 and let them connect it on their own. For example, when I talked about earlier, I really wanted to be a good older sibling. I never read a book that outright told me, you need to be a good big sister. That's a conclusion I naturally drew from how I saw siblings represented in books, which I felt like, you know, you saw so many terrible older siblings, and I did not want to be that. So I hope all of my books, Balder included, will get kids thinking and asking good questions and starting good conversations with their siblings and their parents and their friends. And I also hope my themes are timeless, something that people in 50 years will be able to appreciate just as much as now, because timeless stories are the ones that make an impact, and those are the ones that people will actually remember, are the ones that always apply, no matter the context or the time period, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they just address our humanity, and that is just universal.
Exactly, yeah.
If your book had a theme song, what would it be and why?
I'm not entirely sure. I'm trying to like balance in my head which song would I choose just for the lyrics versus which one is actually like time period appropriate. Because I can think of like several electronica songs that have very applicable lyrics, but that's not quite the vibe of The Balder of Ashton Harper. I don't know about a theme song, but I will say I listened to the soundtrack from the Emma BBC series a lot while writing that book. Not the most recent Emma movie, which I think most people have heard of, but the BBC series that was released in like the early 2000s, I believe. Mm-hmm. I listened to that soundtrack. Like that was my writing soundtrack for The Balder of Ashton Harper. And I love it. The music is beautiful. So I think that's about as close as I could get to a theme song for the book that would actually make sense.
Nice. I love it when people have things that they listen to a lot during a project and just become part of their memory of that project.
Yeah. I can't hear the Emma soundtrack now without just thinking of The Balder of Ashton Harper.
Yeah. What do you think is the most significant thing that you have learned from writing?
From writing in general?
Sure. Or this book in particular.
Yeah. It's interesting because every book I write is always kind of an exploration of ideas I'm dealing with. Sometimes I'll joke that writing my books are therapy, right? Mm-hmm. It's always more than that, right? Because if you just dump all of your emotions on your on a page, that's not necessarily great storytelling. But books have always allowed me to sort of grapple with themes and ideas and different types of people on a page that I can't in real life. So, I mean, writing has taught me so many things. I would say specifically with the Balter of Ashen Harper, like I talked about with those themes of chasing your dreams and how much are you willing to put into that? And are dreams even worth dreaming, right? That's a big thing that I explored in Balter. And that's definitely, I don't know if I necessarily always have an answer to all of those questions surrounding that, but ultimately Balter is about, even in uncertainty, choosing to continuing to Balter, to dance through life with joy, even if you're not always getting it right, you know, and learning to live with that uncertainty, because there's so much uncertainty, especially if you're pursuing a creative career. So that's a big thing that Balter taught me. And it was kind of a lesson I was trying to teach myself, and that's why I chose to write that book. But it came from a place of, like, I started writing it in 2020, and that was a time when I had actually been asked to come speak at a conference, and it was the first conference I would have ever spoken at and been paid to speak at, which was a really big deal for me. It was the Illinois Young Authors Conference, which I'd attended as a student when I was 11 years old, and I was so excited, and I felt like, this is it. This is my big break, right? I can finally, like, help my stories to reach all the people I feel like they should, right? And then, of course, you know, 2020, COVID, life happens, it got canceled. Not only did it get canceled that year, but because it didn't have the funding after that year, that conference got taken down for good, and I never got to go to it. And that just left me grappling with these ideas of, like, I was so close to, like, achieving this huge dream that I always wanted to do, and something completely out of my control just took it away from me, right? And that's a big part of anything in life, even if you're not a writer, if you're not an artist, is learning to deal with the fact that, like, life is so uncertain, and you just have to find joy and be happy with what you can do. So for me, that's the writing. No matter how many books I sell, I'm always going to love, love, love writing my stories. And that's the big important thing that I learned from Balter, and the theme that was very purposeful for that book.
That's great. I'm sorry to hear the conference canceled. Hopefully you will be signed up to speak somewhere again soon.
How did you handle moments of self-doubt or uncertainty about your writing?
Not very well. I'm a very emotional person, and it is difficult for me to keep, like, my emotions from just completely running away from me. I'm very much an Anne Shirley person. You talk about, like, I feel all the highs and lows, right? Mm-hmm. Self-doubt can be very difficult for me. But the biggest thing that I've always stuck to is I've never let it stop me, right? So I might feel down on myself. I might feel down on my writing one day. And I can feel that, but that doesn't mean I'm going to stop writing. That doesn't mean I'm going to stop pursuing this, because ultimately, no matter how I feel, my writing is really, really important to me and to the people who read it. Especially now, I have, you know, reviews, and I've gotten emails from people telling me, you know, how my stories have impacted them. And, you know, that's really powerful to kind of know how your story can impact others' lives. So no matter what I am feeling in the moment, like, feelings are real, but they're not always true.
Yeah.
That's what my parents like to say, right? So I, even though I can feel like it's the end of the world sometimes, it doesn't necessarily mean it's true. My mom has a saying, which I think is super appropriate, that feelings are like children. You don't stuff them in the trunk, but you don't let them drive the car. And I think a lot, that's very helpful. And I also think a lot of, like, creative people who tend to be emotional people, it's a good thing to recognize that, like, self-doubt, at the end of the day, is just a feeling. It doesn't actually affect your reality. Mm-hmm. You can be a super famous writer, and I've read forewords from super famous writers. For example, in the foreword to Ender's Game, which is like considered a modern classic, Orson Scott Card wrote that like he looks back on that book and feels embarrassed about some parts of it. That book that everyone loves. There are countless super famous authors who feel that way. So I think no matter who you are, no matter where you get as a writer or how many readers you have, you're always going to feel self-doubt. It's just a feeling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's lovely. I love your mom's image on children. Feelings in children.
Yes.
Don't shove them in the trunk. Don't let them drive the car. If you could jump into the world of any book, which one would you choose and what role would you play?
Oh, that's a hard one. No. It's difficult. I think I made like a joke about this on Instagram a while ago, but most of my favorite books, if I actually went into that world, I might die.
Yeah.
So
I feel that.
Kind of dangerous fantasy worlds. I will say I would love to be a hobbit. In Hobbiton.
Absolutely.
It's a very, very chill place. I just get to have picnics all the time. That sounds fantastic. Or actually, I don't know if this really counts because it's not really a different world. It's just a different time period. But the time period of like Anne of Green Gables, I think that was a really lovely time in history. I'd love to visit Anne Shirley's Avonlea.
I would love to go there too. Prince Edward Island has always called to me.
Yes. I'm always afraid that Ella Montgomery has made it seem like a bigger deal in my head than it is. And then if I go, I'll be disappointed.
I know a lot of people who have gone and none of them have been disappointed. So that always encourages me.
Okay. Wow. That's honestly quite impressive.
Mm-hmm. So you said you have a couple new projects that you're working on. Can you tell us anything about them?
Yes. So The Balter of Ashton Harper is coming out on October 17th. There's that one. I have another book that I'm actually working on with Sarah McKenzie and her publishing house, Waxwing Books. And we will announce more details about that in October around the time Balter comes out. So you can keep an eye out for that. But right now I'm trying not to say too much about it because it's very exciting. Yeah. And then I just finished another novella that I'm in the process of pitching to my publishers and see if they're interested in it. Oh, and I have a picture book coming out this year. I'm working with the illustrator on it right now. It's called No Snow Yet. And it's the story of a young girl who, while hoping and wishing and waiting for snow, realizes that even without it, the winter world is beautiful.
Oh, I love that.
So those are the main ones. And then, thank you. I'm also in the very depths of working on a trilogy, my first ever series, but that is very far from being done. But I am enjoying it a lot. So.
That's awesome. I'm reading through Inara's first trilogy right now that she started when she was 13, but finished at 16, and even she would be the first to admit that her writing changed drastically over that time period. So I'm in book one, and we're talking about the editing, like, you know, taking an axe to it, kind of like you were, and we're like, okay, we're gonna kill like half these characters, they're gone. And that's really hard.
Yep. So
good to hear about your experience with that process.
It is.
That common one.
Yes. It's a very common one. Don't feel bad about that at all. In fact, you should feel very good about that. Because if you can see all the flaws with your old writing, that means you've improved hugely as a writer. And if you're willing to edit it and like make those big changes, that's also huge. Because there are tons of people who would not do that. So it sounds like you're on the right track, Inara. That is amazing.
Do you have a favorite literary quote that resonates with you as a writer?
I do, although I'm a very quote person. I have a whole Pinterest board just filled with quotes, so it's always hard for me to pick one, but I did pick out one for this podcast, which is, "How vain is it to sit down and write when you have not stood up to live?" Henry David Thoreau. And I think that is so especially important because all of us write from our own personal experiences, whether we mean to or not. You know, you've always heard the phrase, write what you know, when in reality, there's nothing else you can write. You can only write what you know. You can take your lived experience and the things you've heard about, and you can scramble them together and make a story, but ultimately it's all coming from you, right? So a great way to become a better writer is to give yourself more diverse experiences. Travel is great. Mm-hmm. Just like standing up and living and appreciating the world and seeing the world will help you capture that world and put it on the page mm-hmm. with so much more ease and with so much more beauty.
Yeah.
I've been subjecting my girls to a year of yeses. Do you want to share about our year of yeses, Inara?
Not really.
This has been the horror of this year. Is said yes to everything. Anything we got invited to do we said yes. So Inara has been subjected to a bunch of orchestras and bands and plays and outings that her little introverted, anxiety-ridden heart would rather have said no to. But I told her it was for her writing. Basically that quote that you had, like, you can't about what you haven't experienced. So if you ever want to write about someone going to a playhouse, you have to have gone to a playhouse. So yeah,
not even just writing about someone going to a playhouse, right? But also all the things involved in that will allow you to write fantastical versions of that. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I'm trying to think of an example. Like, I wrote a blog post about that. That, for example, maybe you've never fought a dragon, right? Mm-hmm. But you can't write about fighting a dragon unless you know what the heat of fire feels like.
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, you're not writing about a character sitting around a campfire like you have. You can take that experience. You can take the pieces of that experience and weave it into a more fantastical one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree. I think that the quote that you shared, Millie, some might feel is ironic because you are talking about how, like, in that quote, it's like you can't write without living life. And some people might say, mm-hmm. how much life could you have lived by 13? But I think that your follow-up was really good on that of write what you know. And 13-year-olds still have 13 years of personal experience with being a human. And I think that there's a lot that...
Yes.
If you look at the next 13 years of someone's life, right? So if someone was 26 and writing a book, we wouldn't question them. And
right, yeah.
So I think that it also ties into like what Paul told Timothy, don't let people look down on you because of your age. And so I think that we all can just lean into the experience that we have with something and share from what we know. That's all anyone can ever share. And right. So like you said, someone who's 26 who's never felt a fire may not even be able to describe those experiences in a book, whereas a 13-year-old who's been at a campfire every weekend because their parents have a lot of property and that's what they do would be able to write about that. And so I think it's really important not to judge people on their writing just because of their age, because I've been really impressed and blessed by a lot of what I've seen coming out of younger and younger authors in this generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and the thing with younger authors is that you can write stuff that an adult couldn't because you are so close to childhood. Mm-hmm. And the further away you get from childhood, the more difficult it is to remember all those feelings. So I am so happy that I got to write middle grade books as a middle grader when all those like feelings and experiences of being a middle grader were so fresh in my mind. Because even now at age 20, I don't think I can do them quite as much justice as I could at age 13, 14, 15. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it truly is a gift to be able to retain all of those memories and feelings as an adult that you had when you were a kid. And very few authors, like so few authors, are able to just seamlessly do it. I think one of my favorite authors who can do that exceptionally well is Evelyn Sibley Lampman. And she wrote two of my favorite books when I was a kid that have been reprinted by Purple House Press in the last couple of years, Three Knocks on the Wall and Bargain Bride. And one of the things that she does that I love is she, like, you're in someone's brain the whole time. So you're hearing their thoughts, you're hearing what they're thinking. And I love the way they are interacting with ideas. And so that's very Charlotte Mason of her in her style of writing, is showing these kids and middle schoolers and young teens wrestling with ideas up against, like, and holding them against the ideas and beliefs of adults in their lives, and being able to say, is the decision and the life belief that they landed at correct, or was it just because of their own experience and it's okay for me to have a different belief? And that wrestling, it's very hard to authentically write it as an adult. So yes. I could definitely see how still being a kid and writing about kids can make it more relatable. And I think even if you just write a lot when you're young and don't delete it, I'm constantly telling my kids, don't delete your stuff just because you didn't like it.
Yeah, don't delete it.
Because I think that being able to refer back to it as you're older can remind you how you were thinking, how you were feeling at that age. And it gives you this wealth of basically talking to someone who is that age that you can draw from in your future writing, even on an entirely different type of character.
Oh, absolutely. I think another author that does that really, really well is Beverly Cleary in the Ramona books. I love how she takes Ramona, who some of the things that Ramona does, if you walked in on out of context as an adult, you would be like, why are you doing this? Why are you squirting a full tube of toothpaste into the sink? Right? But because you get to see her thought process from the beginning, it makes so much sense to you. Yes. And I, you know, the Ramona books are so funny when you're a little bit older, and you can see all the ironies and the way Ramona talks and thinks and stuff. But when I was younger, I did not understand what my parents were laughing at. I was like, what's funny about this? This is just true. This is just normal. Right? And I think that's the mark of a really good kid's book, if you don't get the jokes about them and their thought process. Right?
When it's just that relatable. We have those experiences all the time. Yeah. And I really think that as a parent myself, parenting special needs kids, one of the big blessings of my life was the books that I read as a kid that did exactly what you're talking about. Like, I read all the Ramona books and the Evelyn Sibley Lampman books that I was talking about, and these books that just let you see what someone else is thinking. I think it gives you a lot of grace for the fact that someone may not be being naughty. They may just be having a different thought process on a situation than you are. My eldest son, he's 11. He recently tore the bindings off a big stack of books. Just like broke the cover binding off of the spine of about 15 books in this vintage series. And I saw this and I just momentarily lost my mind. Like, I could not think of a reasonable reason for anyone to do this. And so it must just be destructive, right? Like, that's all I can think. But because I have this experience in my own life, knowing that as a kid, people would assume I was doing things for a certain reason when I wasn't, and then having that reinforced in these books, I was able to just like fairly calmly sit down with him and be like, what was going through your mind when you were making this life choice? And like, now that he
had a great way to phrase it.
Yeah, yeah. That's how I phrase a lot of things around here. So since he had like had some time, like a day had passed since he had done this because we had just discovered it, he was able to look at it and see how it would look to me. And so one, he was apologetic for breaking my books. And two, he was still able to like explain his thought process, which was one of the books already had the binding broken off, which was accurate. And because it was broken off, he was able to inspect how the binding worked. And he saw that the publishers had stamped a number on the spine. The exterior of the books don't have a number. Oh. And he wanted to know if this was a numbered series, and if so, what order the books went in, because he's my kid who would spend hours when he was little putting the encyclopedias in the right order, and he's all about like patterns. And so he broke the spines on all these books, and he wasn't wrong. The editors did put numbers on every spine. They had to do with printing though, so they didn't actually correlate to the publishing, but just I feel that as a parent, reading the Ramona books is really healthy to help you realize your children aren't just out there to ruin your life. They aren't just out there trying to destroy everything that you have worked hard to earn and the life you've tried to build for your family, and that they really are just learning and exploring and processing and trying to make the world around them make sense. And it may look completely destructive, but I really appreciate authors that are able to guide us to compassion and curiosity. I'm all about curiosity in parenting and like asking my kids, what were you thinking? Why are we doing it this way? What was the plan? What was the goal? Where are we headed? What were we hoping to achieve here? It's really helped, I would say, in ours over there. Mm-hmm-ing, so it must be the right. It must be something that she thinks we aren't doing wrong.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and a lot of that, I think, comes just from a kid being curious, right? Mm-hmm. And what is curiosity? It's just a natural inclination to learn, right? Yeah. Yeah. They just want to learn how the world works. And that often ends, like, leads to stuff like that, like tearing the bindings off of books. Yes. But it's coming from a good place. Yeah. I know when I remember one time when I was younger, I like cut the foam off of a pair of earbuds, which my parents were not happy about, but it was because I wanted to know what was underneath, right?
Yeah, that's how so many inventions happen, is inventors just take other people's inventions apart, see how they worked, and then reconstruct them in a slightly different way. And that's how things get made bigger and better all the time. And I really see that in a lot of what just seems like terrible choices on my son's part, is really just creativity. As I'm saying this, I'm sitting here thinking of the times that he and his brother have chased each other around the kitchen, throwing salt at one another, playing salt tag. That is probably not one of those.
Oh dear.
I think they think, like, the way they've described it is it's like a snowball fight, only it's like inside and it's easier to clean up because there's no water, because I said don't bring snow in. So they just use salt instead. And it made logical sense to them. So not everything is a great idea, and things still have consequences. Knightley did have to earn some money and pay to, you know, buy tape to repair the books. And he did that. I love curiosity for kids. So one question that we have been asking our guests kind of as a closeout question is, what is something that you do for self-care? Because we've spent a lot of time on the podcast historically on our podcast talking about wintering and seasons of trials and tribulations. And we know that a lot of our listeners are in those seasons. And so we just are collecting different ideas of things that people do just to take care of themselves when extra care is needed.
I think a big one for me, and I mentioned this briefly earlier, but is cooking. Mm-hmm. I love to make myself good food. Lately I've had an obsession with making like Chinese noodle dishes, and I had my mom get all the, you know, sesame oil and different types of soy sauce and tamari and stuff so I can make them better. But I think good food goes a long way, and especially like healthy, yummy food when they're mm-hmm. it's a two-in-one. It tastes good and it's really good for you. I think that's super important because it nourishes both your body and your soul. And it's so easy in this day and age to do something quick and often unhealthy. But I think the importance of really like not just the act of eating food, but like sitting down and enjoying it and having the process of like putting it together for yourself is super important. I think that like it, forcing myself to actually make myself lunch mm-hmm. on days when I'm working, like it forces me to give my brain a break for a few mm-hmm. minutes as I make mm-hmm. that food and I eat that food. And I just focus on a very basic human thing, which is eating. But I think that's so important.
Yeah, it really is. And it's often one of the first things to go when people are struggling. So it's a good reminder to do that. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming and talking with us, Millie, and sharing about your writing experience and your books that are coming out. So again, everyone, this was author Millie Florence, and her books will be listed in our show notes. And The Bolter of Ashton Harper released on October 17th and is currently available. And you can find all of the show notes on our website, reshelvingalexandria.com. And thank you for hanging out with us. And remember, the stories are truer than true.